Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Last week, we talked about the Nuremberg trials and the natural law basis for at least the opening statement of former Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson as he prosecuted the Nazi leaders in that first trial. And, of course, it got us thinking a little bit about that whole era in which the world seemed to come apart. And we wonder, why didn't other Catholics take stands? Well, we have a man who is probably at this moment underappreciated, but who at the time was arguably Hitler's enemy number one in those early years. Dietrich von Hildebrand, whose wife, Alice, has been on this program many times. Well, we're blessed to have his memoir translated and edited by John Henry Crosby. And John joins me right now. It's published in the volume, My Battle Against Hitler, Defiance in the Shadow of the Third Reich. And it's great to have you, John. Thanks.
Al, I'm delighted to be on your show again. Thanks for having me back.
I understand today's your birthday? Or is it von Hildebrand's birthday?
It's von Hildebrand's 127th
I was going to say, you guys share the same birthday.
Yeah, that would be very generous of you to have me on my birthday, Beth. Today we're celebrating Dietrich von Hildebrand, yeah.
Oh, good. A lot of our listeners have no idea who he is. And this is a man of extraordinary intellect, courage, and capacity for struggle and suffering. So tell us a little bit about his background.
Right. Well, I think to take right off from where you began, it's true he's underappreciated. A lot of people do know his name or know some of the titles of his more famous books. So there's a very famous and much-loved book called Transformation in Christ.
That's actually how I first came in contact with him, was that
right,
book.
Right, right. It's a classic, and it's in print with Ignatius Press. I think it's been in print without any interruption, I may be wrong on this, for nearly 60 or so years in English. Mm-hmm. So a real classic. There are other books like The Heart, which is much loved by Catholics, and then, of course, some of the more polemical books. There was one called The Trojan Horse in the City of God. So people often find themselves recognizing who he is through some of the book titles. But you're right, the life is little known, and in particular, this extraordinary chapter of his life in becoming enemy number one, public enemy number one of the Nazis, in Germany and then in Austria. And this book finally plugs that gap, and it does it in a very powerful way because it's not just a biography written by someone else, however capable. It's a memoir written in his own words for his wife, Alice. And for the listeners who are sort of doing the math, how can someone be 127 years old and still have a living widow? Well, she was his second wife, his first wife, who lived with him through this dramatic period, passed away in the 50s, and then later he married Alice, who was much younger than he is, mm-hmm. and that led to the memoir, because she regretted. She said, I've missed so much of your life. And he said, well, I'll write it for you. And so he produced a long memoir. She called it the longest love letter ever written, full of details about his life from his youth through his conversion to Catholicism, which, again, many people don't know. He's a convert, an ardent convert. And then, of course, of great interest here, this remarkable fight against Nazism, for which he sacrificed so much. And so finally we have his memoirs describing it, and also, as a more than just a bonus, a third of the book contained the newspaper articles that he published in his own newspaper, which was the leading journal of the intellectual resistance in Austria at the time. So you're doing a great service, Al, by giving some airtime to help recover this man's legacy.
Well, we need to remember our heroes and our saints. And I'm actually of Austrian extraction myself, so he has special interest for me. But the memoir covers what years?
Well, it begins in amazingly, 1921. Mm-hmm. And I say amazingly because it's actually already, the memoir that we published in this book is exclusively connected with the fight against Nazism. So here's a man in 1921, when there was barely a Nazi party, already an open opponent of theirs, blacklisted by them, targeted shortly thereafter for execution by them. So the story begins early. I think one can say Dietrich von Hildebrand was the first major German and perhaps major German Catholic who opposed the Nazis publicly, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. I think that we have to always bear in mind when we think about our heroes what we're admiring them for. And with von Hildebrand, we have to admire his courage, no doubt about it. Someone who gives up his homeland, gives up his career, gives up his family and friends to go to a foreign country to cross the border into Austria and establish a journal. I mean, that's of extraordinary significance, and we should all be ready to make similar sacrifices if we're asked. But I think there's maybe a lack of moral imagination in many of us where we read his memoirs in a somewhat self-congratulatory way, because after the Holocaust, the Nazis more or less equal ultimate evil. It's hard to see any attraction.
Right.
But at the time,
that's right,
there was a great deal of attraction. And von Hildebrand's achievement, I think, is in some sense an intellectual achievement, and one that we all have to cultivate in ourselves. And that was the ability to see with such piercing clarity what Nazism really was, long before the evil consequences began to show themselves. At the time, it was attractive. Many Catholics were trying to build bridges with it.
That's right. And, of course, this is one of the marks of spiritual maturity, according to the book of Hebrews, that we have our senses trained to discern good and evil. And he had that kind of moral discernment very early on. How did the Nazi movement get his attention?
Very interesting that you should ask, because it wasn't, again, maybe in terms of its sort of the worst fruits of it that we associate, you know, with the terrible anti-Semitism and so on. It really began with its sort of its core components. So Nazism was an outgrowth of lots of cultural and political movements of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, an extreme nationalism characterized the Nazis. So an aggressive loyalty to Germany, but over and against any other country. So it wasn't the patriotism that von Hildebrand would have called for, in fact, but it was a kind of hostility, you know, love of your country at the expense of other countries.
Right.
And von Hildebrand detected that in the air and decried it because he thought that it was unchristian. He thought that it was small-minded, ultimately, and he called instead for a kind of patriotism. And at the time, that was really important because the political parties were very polarized, not unfamiliar to us today, around people who were, much of the polarization was connected to people who were extremely nationalist in outlook. And so von Hildebrand took aim at that. And in fact, he went to a peace conference in Paris in 1921 and was sort of put on the spot. And he was more or less asked to prove his loyalty to Germany by clearing them of all guilt connected to World War I. And he refused to do that.
Mm.
And when he got home, it's amazing, it seems like such a small act. When he got home, he was all over the news, as we would say. He had, there was a lot of public denunciation of him. He was reported as having been a traitor in France, and he had to answer for himself. And that's what put him on the radar of the Nazis. And in fact, in 1923, just a few years later, when there was a first attempt by the Nazis to seize power, there was this famous Beer Hall Putsch, which did end disastrously for Hitler.
Yeah.
It was in Munich, yes. It ended badly, but for, 24 hours, any opponent of the Nazis had to be very afraid, and Hitler. In fact, Hildebrand fled out of Munich. So that was the beginning. You might say a modest beginning, an unlikely beginning, but it was it shows that to be the enemy of a political paradigm or even a great evil in the world isn't necessarily measured by action in the conventional sense. In other words, you can be enemy number one, perhaps even more so if you aim at the intellectual and spiritual roots of an evil and not just at its fruits and at its manifestations.
Very, very good. Very true. When Hitler and the Nazis come into Austria in the Anschluss, was he already gone, or was that the occasion for him finally leaving?
Right. Well, he was still there, and so just to sort of summarize that little piece of history there. So von Hildebrand went to Vienna in late 1933. So he spent the end of 1933 until March of 1938, when Hitler would invade Austria and exit. He spent it in the Austrian capital in Vienna, and published nearly 70 articles from there. Was a significant voice in the perhaps one of the leaders of the intellectual resistance, one of the great voices against anti-Semitism, particularly among Christians. We can come back to that. And he wanted to stay as long as he could. And so he remained there until the time of the Anschluss, and I see our time is running out, so that he could continue to pressure the Austrian government to do the right thing and to lead people and strengthen their convictions.
Hold it there, John Henry. We'll come back and continue conversation about the life of Dietrich von Hildebrand, his memoir, a sample of his writings in the book My Battle Against Hitler, Defiance in the Shadow of the Third Reich. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, John Henry Crosby, who translated and edited the memoir of Dietrich von Hildebrand and a number of his columns and articles in the book My Battle Against Hitler. Dietrich von Hildebrand was a rising star in German intellectual circles and may well have been the first German of stature to oppose the Nazis in the public square. He was an outspoken Catholic that stood up against the Nazis and their doctrines of anti-Semitism and extreme nationalism and their jumbled social policy. When do we have the first record that the Nazis are aware of him?
Well, it depends on how you define record. I mean, I mentioned in the previous segment that when he went to this peace conference in Paris and made conciliatory statements about the French and about the Great World War that was so...
He came on the radar at that point.
He came on the radar in the sense that there was an editor of a Nazi newspaper there, or what became an important Nazi newspaper, and he wrote this sort of character assassination of sorts of the Hildebrand. But then in 1923, we spoke earlier also about this famous Beerhall Putsch. This was the first attempt of Hitler to seize power and not just be a force in the party politics of the day. And von Hildebrand had to flee. And in fact, he had been warned through an assistant of his who had said to a man who I think had been injured in the war, and she was a nurse in a clinic, and he was just poisoned by Nazi ideology and completely consumed by this. And she said to him, "Oh, you have to meet Professor von Hildebrand. He will set you straight and remove all of these errors in your thinking." And he said, that evil Dietrich von Hildebrand, that traitor, we have him on our radar, and we will we will deal with him as soon as we possibly can." So that was an important little warning that he received because, this was prior to later years when he was being warned by official outlets in Austria and so on. This was just a kind of a word-of-mouth thing by chance. And so it helped him to know that he needed to flee already in 23. So those are the earliest records and those that really establish him in that role. But, of course, it continued to happen. I mean, as his voice grew in prominence, I mean, ultimately, for example, when he had to leave Munich and go to Austria, he received a questionnaire from the University of Munich, and he was asked, this is this famous Aryan questionnaire that lots of people had to submit to prove their true, pure German blood, and he was asked, "Are you of Aryan descent?" And he could have said yes. He had a Jewish grandmother, but she had been baptized and raised Protestant, and there was no religious element at all in her background, and it was sufficiently diluted, as the Nazis would have said, but he did not want to have any kind of transaction with the Nazis, and he thought even complying by their rules would be that. And so he wrote a defiant no on the questionnaire. Well, that got him fired from the University of Munich. That was an act of political defiance that you might say that would have pushed his profile in the Nazi, in their activities of surveillance and so on. And of course, that only grew. Once he had an anti-Nazi newspaper in Vienna, and given its profile, let's put it this way, in the final years, final months before Hitler invaded Austria, particularly terrifying meeting between him and the Austrian chancellor, and he just bullied this man who was not a strong figure but was still working for the independence of Austria. Mm-hmm. And among his demands, this was Schuschnigg. So Dollfuss was the chancellor who got Hildebrand started and funded his newspaper, and then Hildebrand underwent a terrible defeat when Nazis in Austria assassinated the Austrian chancellor. I mean, just extraordinarily dramatic moment in his life. And the successor to Dollfuss was a man named Schuschnigg, a good man, a Catholic, but not a strong man, and somewhat taken in by some of this talk about the brotherhood of Germany and Austria, and so not a man with enough principled resistance to resist Hitler's push. But when Hitler pulled Schuschnigg in and more or less brutalized him, and among other things, he took away his cigarettes, which he knew would make him terribly anxious because Schuschnigg was apparently a chain smoker. But he did everything to intimidate Schuschnigg. But one of his demands was that Schuschnigg immediately suspend the newspaper of Dietrich von Hildebrand. So that's extraordinary piece of evidence that by the very end, just before the invasion of Austria, von Hildebrand's newspaper had become a thorn in the side even of the official policy, between Germany and Austria.
Now, I understand the Nazis sentenced him to death in absentia?
Right. Yeah. So it's not entirely clear to me what that would have amounted to, but when he was declared, what they did is it accompanied a number of other things. It was the firing from the university, and shortly after that, he was expatriated, which I believe meant that he simply lost his German citizenship entirely.
Okay.
And in that context, he was also sentenced to death for traitorous acts. Now, I just to be clear, I don't believe that necessarily meant they had singled him out. I think there was a category of people. But nevertheless, I mean, he certainly couldn't have gone back to Germany under the Nazi rule.
Now, when was his conversion to Catholicism?
It was many years before.
Okay.
It was in 1914. The seeds for it go back into his childhood. Our listeners should know that he was raised in a completely non-religious home. It wasn't like he was raised in a Protestant home and then converted or a Jewish home or anything of that sort. It was a-religious, but there was a religion of sorts, and that was the religion of beauty and art. His father was a revered sculptor in Germany, one of the most famous of the day. And it was a family there was a very high level of love of beauty and culture, and not in a sense of sort of excessive refinement and the like. This was their contact with reality.
Yeah.
It was through beauty that they sensed what was important about the world. So he had that gift, you might say, of a strong sense for the beautiful. And it's interesting, when he converted to Christianity, it was really through the beauty of the saints and the beauty of Christ. He had a friend who said, the Catholic Church is the true church because she produces saints. And it was the beauty of the sanctity that captivated Hildebrand. So he didn't come like a Cardinal Newman, you know, through reading history, or like a St. Augustine, who had a great conversion. But he came through the way of beauty, which I think is very significant for our own time. And it certainly explains why he had such a heightened sense for things. You know, people who have a sense for beauty are generally very intuitive, and they sense things about what was going on. And von Hildebrand had an enormous sense for what was in the air.
Yes.
And that included something like Nazism, which was, it certainly had a siren song and a great appeal, so you might say it had a kind of certain aspect of beauty, but of course it was a false beauty. It was a fraud.
Many of us today don't understand what the appeal of Nazism was. I mean, you know, we've seen the movies, we know how the story ends, we see Hitler as kind of a raving, pathetic figure. We see the regimentation, and, you know, I mean, if you don't believe in the devil, then you usually invoke Hitler as the figure, as the greatest personification of evil. So what was the appeal to the German people of Nazism?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question. There's not an easy answer to it. And I think also it's one of those questions where you have to appeal to a high level of historical and even moral imagination on our parts, because it is very inconceivable. As you say, it's more or less the standard of evil, I mean, to refer to Hitler or the Nazis.
Right.
But, I mean, certainly as a movement, they played into perhaps perennial, and certainly at that moment, German weaknesses. So, for example, if you think about the tremendous sense of humiliation after World War I and the Treaty of Versailles that imposed such just draconian restrictions on Germany's ability to, its economy was crushed, its military couldn't grow, and this was a time perhaps where, I mean, maybe in our polarized world of today, with parties drawing such significant lines between us and our fellow Americans, it's hard to understand, you know, the power of these collective movements fully. But in any case, Hitler spoke to that, and he was going to restore German pride, and he was going to restore the German economy, and he was going to defy ultimately the Treaty of Versailles. So things like that were very significant. Another example is something that maybe he exploited. That's anti-Semitism. You know, anti-Semitism, which again we think of as a complete, there's absolutely no respectability to it, but there was a polite anti-Semitism of the day, and it was often lined up with conservatives, because anti-Semitism was, the Jews were the source of liberal ideas. They were they had a cartel, so to speak, around banking and the like. And so for lots of more conservative-leaning Catholics and Germans of the day, they were really suspect. I mean, this whole threat from the Red Threat from Moscow was perpetually being exploited in the German in German military propaganda, especially. So this is something that Hitler exploited masterfully, because you know all of these Germans who were sympathetic to anti-Semitism, they didn't promote gas chambers and want to destroy the Jewish people. I mean, for the most part, it was a feeling that this was a foreign population and a negative presence in German culture. And Hitler just brilliantly exploited that for his ends. Hildebrand says in one place that the presence of anti-Semitism throughout European countries, he says, even in America, broke down the moral barrier to Nazism. And what he means is that people couldn't see it clearly because they had such a sympathy for an aspect of it.
Wow. Many people don't realize, too, that the Nazis were real pioneers in the field of propaganda, graphics, design. And while we don't look on their aesthetic with pleasure today, from a mass appeal, that's what they were shooting for. And Hitler's use of the airplane to campaign is another example of how it was a cutting-edge group.
Absolutely. Cutting-edge group, and the use of propaganda was brilliant. It exploited things Germans were proud of. Von Hildebrand, for example, thought that the use of the music of Richard Wagner was a terrible exploitation on the part of the Germans, of the Nazis. But he thought more broadly the use of German culture was co-opted by the Nazis. And again, it gave them, you know, they dressed themselves in the mantle of this great and phenomenal culture and cultural history, and one that so many Germans loved. Hildebrand loved it.
Yep.
But he spent a lot of his time, so to speak, denying the Nazis the right to do that. Not that they didn't achieve it through their propaganda, but he was very firm in pointing out what an abuse this was of a culture that was great and by no means, you know, united in spirit with Nazism.
We've got only about 90 seconds left. What happens after he leaves Austria? Where does he go, and where does he end up?
Well, let me plug the book and say you can find out more about that in the book. And I should
Absolutely.
Say also, this is the paperback edition of the book. It came out in hardback in 2014, and the paperback has a wonderful new introduction by Sir Roger Scruton, one of the most significant voices of English conservative thought,
yes.
but really a mainstream figure, and he reflects beautifully on Hildebrand's diagnosis of the ideology at the heart of Nazism. And it has a wonderful new index. In any case, it's soon to be out with Random House, and so I plug that. People can read about it there. But as far as Hildebrand, just briefly, so that people know where he went, he fled Austria, went to Czechoslovakia and then Switzerland. He was there for nearly a year, and then he taught in France at a Catholic institute. And then he had a most extraordinary flight from continental Europe via Brazil to the United States. And for many of us, we know him thanks to his American period, where he wrote many books in English. He taught at Fordham College, had a whole new generation of students, met his wife, his second wife, Alice von Hildebrand.
John Henry, thank you so much.